This is New Testament Theology, cassette number 2, side B. Well, let's continue with this twofold way of appreciating the theology of the Synoptic Gospels, especially that we've already talked about. We'll pick up on it with the Gospel of John later on in the lectures. But we're going to focus on the one hand upon Christology, the person and work of Jesus Christ. On the other hand, the subject of discipleship. And here we're talking about human response to the person and work of Jesus Christ. I believe this is what the Gospels are all about, theologically speaking. They are about presenting the person and work of Christ, of course, assumed to be the at the same time the person and work of God, and also presented in such a way as to evoke some kind of response from human beings by way of discipleship. You see this pattern in numerous interactions and episodes throughout the life and ministry of Jesus. There's the presentation of Christ through some act, activity, healing, whatever, teaching, and often those two are very much intertwined. The healings are also episodes of teaching, and then there's the element of human response in the process. The two are very closely intertwined, the way in which the Gospels present Jesus Christ. There's no abstract presentation of Christology. Again, back to this, we refer back to this whole business of the mode of theology as we have it in our Gospel writings. It's not classical mode theology. Everything is not systematically laid out. These are the attributes of Christ, and so on, but it's a kind of active presentation of Christ. Christ in a constant engagement with human beings. There's a sort of a presentation of Christ on the road, so to speak. And in numerous ways, we see this kind of theology coming to the fore. The Christology hinges upon the discipleship, and discipleship is always very closely related to the Christology. There's a tight connection between these two in the Gospels and all the many forms in which we find Jesus in the Gospels. So, now, what we can do as we go along with the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, is that at some point we will explore these two areas. We will look at the Christology of each one and the related subject of discipleship. We'll do other things as well, as we suggested in the early lecture, but these two really give us some handles on what is going on in these writings, theologically speaking, I believe, in ways that keep us close to the actual form and the inherent nature of these writings. What I wish to do at this point is to give you, by way of an exegetical example, some insight into what we've been talking about as we have discussed the theological nature of the Gospels. What we will do is simply take a segment of the crucifixion narrative as we find it recorded in the Gospel of Matthew, Matthew chapter 27, verses 38 to 54. And we'll look at this narrative and we'll ask questions about the theological nature of the narrative and how it fits into the narrative of the Gospel of Matthew as a whole. And I think you might be able to see some connections here between our exegetical treatment of this particular narrative and what we've been saying up to this point about the nature of the theology that we find in the Gospels, the kind of doctrine that we have here as we embark upon our attempt to appreciate each one of these writings individually. If you would turn in your Bible to Matthew chapter 27 and look along with me at verses 38 through 54. At this point, of course, the arrest of Jesus has taken place. He has been tried and he has been condemned both before the Jewish court and before Roman officials. Then we pick up with verse 38. He's already been placed upon the cross. Then two robbers who were crucified with him, one on the right and one on the left. Then two robbers were crucified with him, one on the right and one on the left. And those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads and saying, "You who would destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross." So also the chief priests with the scribes and elders mocked him, saying, "He saved others. He cannot save himself. He is the King of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross, and we will believe in him. He trusts in God. Let God deliver him. For he said, 'I am the Son of God.'" And the robbers who were crucified with him also reviled him in the same way. Now from the sixth hour there was darkness over all the land until the ninth hour. And about the ninth hour Jesus cried with a loud voice, "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani," that is, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" And some of the bystanders, hearing it, said, "This man is calling Elijah," confusing the expression "Eli, Eli" with the name for Elijah. And one of them at once ran and took a sponge, filled it with vinegar, and put it on a reed, and gave it to him to drink. But the others said, "Wait, let's see whether Elijah will come to save him." And Jesus cried again with a loud voice, and yielded up his spirit. And behold, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom, and the earth shook, and the rocks were split. The tombs also were opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. And coming out of the tombs after his resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many. When the centurion and those who were with him, keeping watch over Jesus, saw the earthquake and what took place, they were filled with awe and said, "Truly this was the Son of God." Now we could divide this passage up into several sections. First section, verses 38 to 44, we could entitle "The Mocking of Jesus, the Son of God." Second section, verses 45 to 50, "The Death of Jesus, the Son of God." And then the final section, verses 51 to 54, "The Vindication of Jesus, the Son of God." Because of the language of the text and the recurring motifs and the context in the Gospel of Matthew, I would argue that this passage has to do with the ultimate test of Jesus, the Son of God, who, rather than seeking his own salvation, gives himself over completely to death that others might be saved. It almost goes without saying that the title Son of God is significant in the context of the passage, significant for Matthew and his presentation of Christ in the passage. This title, you might recall, has not been mentioned since the trial back in the 26th chapter. There are other titles which have become prominent between the trial and now the time of Jesus' crucifixion. The King of the Jews, King of Israel, Christ, Messiah. All of a sudden now, we find the title Son of God reappearing in these 17 verses, and it appears several times in them. We find it used by the passers-by who mock Jesus, the religious leaders who mock him, and finally by the centurion and the guards who proclaim him to be the Son of God. I think we can conclude from this that Jesus' identity as the Son of God is somehow very important to the crucifixion scene. What we find here, if we take this scene seriously within the context of the Gospel of Matthew as a whole, is an ultimate test of Jesus, the Son of God, a test which has been foreshadowed earlier in the Gospel, back in the 4th chapter, verses 1 through 11. You remember following the baptismal declaration, you might turn to this and take a look at it, back in the 3rd chapter of Matthew, following the baptismal declaration of Jesus' divine sonship, at the end of chapter 3, we find then a kind of immediate leading of Jesus by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. No sooner has God declared, "This is my beloved Son," chapter 3, verse 17, "with whom I am well pleased," than the narrative records for us, then Jesus is led into the wilderness by the Spirit for this time of temptation. He fasts 40 days and 40 nights, and afterward he was hungry. Matthew tells us, "And the tempter came and said to him, 'If you are the Son of God, command these stones to become loaves of bread,'" so on and so forth. It's remarkable the emphasis upon divine sonship and the temptation when you compare it now with the crucifixion narrative. The phraseology, if you are the Son of God, and of course Satan knows good and well who Jesus is. As a matter of fact, based upon understanding of the nature of the conditional language in the Greek, some have suggested that this could be translated instead of if you are the Son of God, since you are the Son of God, because of the type of conditional sentence that's being used in the mood of the verb. Really, from Satan's perspective, whether Jesus is the Son of God is not being called into question. Satan knows very well who Jesus is. Makes me think of the book of James. You believe that God is one, you do well, even the demons believe and and shudder. But it's because he knows he is the Son of God that he challenges him in this way. He is challenging him ultimately to deny his identity as the Son of God, or to do that which would be contrary to his identity as the Son of God. The test really amounts to this. Will Jesus use his powers in a self-aggrandizing fashion for himself, for his own need, or will he deny himself ultimately to the point of death, which is where we are in the text over in the later on in the crucifixion narrative. But we got a little window here, I think, into what ultimately happens and what Jesus' life and ministry is all about. One big test of his divine sonship. And throughout the Gospel of Matthew, we have testimony after testimony to Jesus' self-denying and saving mission as the Son of God. He is declared to be Jesus. He is given the name Jesus early on, chapter 1, verse 21, for he will save his people from their sins. And then picking up with the correct confession of the disciples at Caesarea Philippi, especially the confession of Peter in the 16th chapter of the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus then begins to predict his suffering, ultimately his death and his resurrection from the dead. And then you have a series of so-called passion predictions that come between the time we pick up in Matthew 16, moving toward the a crucifixion of Jesus. And this is what his ministry is all about, ultimately, to deny himself and to save others, not to save himself, not to do anything that would distract him from that mission that he has been given by God the Father. And each one of these temptations from Satan is a temptation to distract Jesus, to deny his identity as the Son of God, to do that which would, in effect, deny what he is about, to work a miracle to meet his own need versus meeting the needs of others, to seek power and glory, to throw himself down from the pinnacle of the temple to put on a glory show for the crowds. That's not what his ministry is all about. That's not what his miracles are all about. This is why he often says, you know, keep this quiet. Don't go out and broadcast this. He wants to avoid the kind of sensationalism associated with the temptation here on the part of Satan when he takes him to the high point of the temple complex and tempts him to throw himself down to make a big show of these things. All of this is contrary to his inherent nature and identity as the Son of God. No. Matthew presents Jesus' death as the ultimate test of Jesus, the Son of God. A test foreshadowed here in the fourth chapter. Jesus, the Son of God, who rather than acting out of self-interest, acts out of total devotion to God and perfect love for his neighbor. There's a kind of irony to the use of salvation having, the use of words having to do with salvation in our text in the 26th chapter, back over in the 27th chapter of the Gospel of Matthew, the crucifixion narrative, 27, 38, and following. People are tempting Jesus to save himself, and there's a battery of terms that are used, save yourself, come down from the cross, and so on. The irony is that the mockers do not really know what they are saying. In fact, if we know truly the whole story, if we know the outcome, if we read the story from the cross backwards, the believing reader knows that Jesus will be proven to be the Son of God precisely by his not succumbing to the temptation. The mockers are saying, if you are the Son of God, do this or do that. Save yourself. Come down. But reading from the cross backwards, knowing Jesus' true identity as the Son of God, we know that this precisely is what establishes his divine sonship, or verifies it, bears testimony to it. And of course, the centurion and the guards with him, following events surrounding Jesus' death, they make the affirmation, truly this was the Son of God, they say, in the light of the cross and what happens with the cross. It's interesting, the pattern on the part of these mockers, in some way or another, they all challenge Jesus in relation to his divine sonship. But unbeknownst to them, they're contributing to the very test by which his divine sonship is actually proven. And again, this is seen only in light of the cross. The passers-by, they taunt him in relation to his divine sonship. They say, if you are the Son of God, come down from the cross. Likewise, the religious leaders taunt him and mock him. He trusts in God. Let God deliver him now if he desires him. For he said, I am the Son of God. And the scripture records in the same way the bandits, the robbers, taunt Jesus. And we can assume that there's some challenge, implicit challenge there to his divine sonship. The mockers essentially challenge Jesus to prove his divine sonship by what would in effect be a denial of that sonship. And then ironically, the pagan Roman soldiers appreciate the significance of Jesus' divine sonship, confessing him truly to be the Son of God only after the ordeal of his crucifixion. So we see that all things in the gospel narrative come to make sense in the light of the cross. And of course, there is a certain paradox associated with the cross in its presentation of the person and work of Jesus Christ, the Christology associated with the Gospels. Fact is, this Jesus has not come as a sword-wielding, mighty, conquering warrior. Contrary to a lot of messianic expectation of the day, he comes instead as a willing servant, humble. His humble entry into Jerusalem that the Gospels record for us, the humble way in which he ministers and serves. As a matter of fact, those who may have had certain messianic expectations associated with David, King David, and the line of David, are perhaps challenged by the way in which the expression Son of David is even used in the Gospel narrative. In the case of the Gospel of Matthew, only people who are in dire need use this expression, Son of David. And in some cases, outsiders and no accounts by current standards of society. Blind beggars, the Canaanite woman, pleading for mercy from Jesus, accenting all the more the way in which Matthew presents Jesus as royal Messiah in a heavily nuanced way, a way that's heavily nuanced by the cross, by his suffering and death, by the outcome of his life and ministry. This one who is the Son of God is precisely so, proven to be so, because of the willing and humble ministry in which he is engaged to save and to redeem, to save his people from their sins. And then he shows it in so many ways throughout his earthly ministry, in the ways he deals with people, heals, deals with his disciples, and so on. And that ministry, quite logically, according to the standards of gospel logic, redemptive historical logic, ends up in the suffering and the death of Jesus, and ultimately the vindication of that outcome by way of the resurrection and the divine response to the death of Jesus. But make no mistake about it, the resurrection is not a rescue of Jesus from the cross. He fully undergoes death and goes into the grave, experiences fully the power of death and the power of agony and suffering, feeling the brunt of human sin and all of its weight. And then God responds in a vindicating act through the resurrection, raising Jesus from the dead, and the spotlight still stays on the cross somehow. The cross, again, is the orthodox center, gives us the proper theological frame of reference for appreciating the presentation of the ministry and person of Jesus Christ in the gospel narratives. Now, again, as we've already said, the theology that comes to us in the Gospels is not abstract theology. It's inseparably related to discipleship, issues of discipleship and human response. The presentation of the person and work of Christ is there intentionally to evoke response of some sort, either on the part of already believing readers who encounter these things, are reminded of these things, and challenged to deeper levels of commitment and discipleship, or unbelieving readers. The Gospels preserve for us the memory of the person and ministry of Jesus so that all human beings might be confronted with these things, and so that the church might be encouraged to use the record that we have to confront the world with the truth of the gospel, such that people might respond one way or another. So there's a lot of implicit discipleship given in narratives such as this. The pattern of Jesus' life is not just given to tell us what happened to Jesus and what his life was all about, but it's a pattern given to challenge us with our lives, to raise fundamental questions about the pattern of our lives. What direction are we headed? Where do we derive meaning in life? What is the purpose? Toward what outcomes are we shooting? Are we aiming? There are fundamental challenges here to all of us in these narratives and in the way Jesus is presented in the Gospels. What will it be for each one of us? We can journey along with the disciples themselves as they wrestled with these things. You know, Peter, back at Caesarea Philippi in the 16th chapter of the Gospel of Matthew, made this confession: "Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God." Peter had it right. He was orthodox, was he not, in some sense or another? And then Jesus makes this declaration about the keys of the kingdom of heaven and the founding of the church and all of that. Well, just a little while later, Jesus begins to instruct his disciples about what's coming up in Jerusalem, his suffering, his death, and his resurrection from the dead. What does Peter do? This one who made the orthodox confession, he takes him aside and begins to rebuke him, saying, "God forbid, Lord, this shall never happen to you." Jesus turns to him: "Get behind me, Satan, for a hindrance to me, for you are not on the side of God, but of men." And then Jesus gives some teaching about following him, denying self, gaining the world, forfeiting one's life. What does it profit a person? And declaring, whoever would save his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. And so we find some strong teaching on the subject of discipleship, some very challenging teaching on the subject of discipleship, implicit throughout, sometimes explicit as is the case here, but implied all the way throughout by the pattern and course of Jesus' life and ministry. We are challenged in our discipleship. What will it be for us? Is it our passion to do the will of the Father? Where does our agonizing over sacrifice and ministry come out at the end of the day? So there's a lot of teaching and challenge here related to discipleship that we can see in this exegetical example keying upon the Gospel of Matthew in particular. In the time remaining, let's briefly revisit the question of the nature of the Gospels by asking us about their genre, what type of literature they represent, what sort of communication form do the Gospels represent. I always enjoy asking students the question, are the Gospels biographies in the modern sense of the word? Why or why not? It's very easy to see that the Gospels are not exactly like biographies in the modern sense of the word. We have a lot of chronological gaps in them. There are things about them that, when compared with modern biographies, are very, very strange, it would seem. There's very little on Jesus' childhood and early development, very little on his family relations and home life. is a strong, intense focus on the several years or so of his adult ministry. Also, there's a general impress in detail, the date of Jesus' birth and death. There's a kind of bland description of geography at times, desert, mountain, things aren't very precisely noted. At other times, there is a precision given, but there's not a kind of consistent precision that we might associate with modern biography writing. And then the strangest thing of all, there's this strong emphasis upon the death of the main figure at the end of the narrative. We might recall the statement by Kaler, the Passion, the Gospels being Passion narratives with extended introduction. Fact is, in the Gospel narratives, we don't just have bare facts. We have facts, but those facts are embedded within an interpretative frame of reference, especially set by the Passion and the significance of the cross and events surrounding the cross. Now, the fact that there is an interpretative framework doesn't mean that in any way we call into question the accuracy of the history that's presented. It's just that the history comes to us within an interpretative frame of reference. We have facts and interpretation of the facts at one and the same problem, one and the same time. And you can be sure that the gospel writers, the gospel compilers, didn't just put these things together to preserve a memory. They had definite aims and purposes in mind within the communities where they wrote. They desired to present the person and the ministry of Jesus Christ in such a way that people would be persuaded of the truth of these things, would see it for what it really is. So under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, not only are the facts given and recorded for us accurately, but the meaning of the facts is recorded for us accurately as well. The fact that Jesus died for the purpose of salvation, to redeem humanity. What these facts amount to is an essential part of the gospel story. And when you can compare these gospels with other biographies, Greco-Roman biographies, you find some points of overlap between them and ancient biographical forms. Yet when all is said and done, they stand out as a kind of unique form of communication in the ancient world. Various scholars have studied ancient biographies and attempted to call attention to points of comparison that do shed light here and there upon the nature of the gospel genre, the gospels as forms of communication. When all is said and done, out of those attempts to identify the gospels as a specific genre of communication, we affirm that these gospels were not forged in a vacuum. They were forged in viable church communities for the benefit of those communities, to edify them, and to preserve a witness to the person and ministry of Jesus Christ for the world, to evoke response. The gospels simply are narratives about Jesus, forged within the Christian community to instruct and inform those communities, to evoke praise from God's people, to convince and persuade the world. So they are church documents, mission documents. In every way, they provide us with the foundation of what we are about in the life and ministry of the church. They are our foundational and constitutional documents, again, analogous to the Torah, the fundamental instructional documents of the Old Testament canon, giving us insight into the redemptive activity of God in relation to us and the world, instructing us, calling us to worship, and calling us to engage in mission. And this is what is exciting about this study that we are engaged upon. This theology drives us into practice and response, places upon us responsibility that we can now explore in each individual writing through the rest of the New Testament.